I'd like to welcome you to the next in our series on Global Health Perspectives podcasts. My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And it's my real delight to have friend and colleague Tiki Pang join me all the way from Singapore. Tiki, it seems just like yesterday when we were last in Geneva together at WHO. I'd love you maybe just to start talking about your work in Malaysia and then how it led to you moving to Geneva and WHO.
Yeah, I mean, my basic training, Derek, is in immunology of infectious diseases. So after completing my PhD, I worked for 22 years in Malaysia in a sort of purely academic environment. That means teaching, research, and a bit of hospital work in diagnostics. But as a result of my research in the late 80s, early 90s, in the areas of dengue and typhoid fever, I started getting invited to Geneva to their scientific groups on vaccine development. That's how it all started. So started going to Geneva, and then around 1998, I was at a meeting with Julio Frank soon after he joined Dr. Brundtland's team. And he said to me, hey, there's this position that I'm going to advertise very soon called Director for Research Policy. So he asked me, why don't you apply? So I told him, I know nothing about research policy. I'm a researcher. He said, doesn't matter. In fact, that's what we're looking for. We don't want someone who knows policy. We want someone who's a scientist. So to cut a long story short, I joined the WHO in 1999, a year after Brundtland. And I remember asking Julio on my first day at work, please tell me what is the meaning of the word policy. And I also asked him, why did you not recruit someone who knows about policy? And he said, that's exactly what we don't want. We don't want someone who knows about policy. We want someone who is a true scientist. So that's how it all started. It was a steep learning curve, but I've enjoyed it greatly. And I think you basically probably had the same kind of motivation for joining WHO. If you recall, Julio was in charge of a cluster called Evidence and Information for Policy. So that was an amazing 13 years at WHO under Julio, and then of course under Chris Murray, and then under Tim Evans. So it was a very rewarding experience for me to be joining WHO at that time.
And it's fascinating now, and we'll get back to it in a few minutes, how Chris Murray is now sitting at the center of discussing the models on COVID-19 in the US, and David Nabarro is playing a big role supporting the Director General on the COVID strategy, both being members of the cabinet. I think a fascinating time when science was put out front as the driving force of what we should do, and that's why they probably wanted to make sure they had a strong scientist first in place in the research field. So I'd love to know then, when you left WHO, there's life after WHO. The last decade and a bit has seen you move between Singapore and Geneva. And what has been your work in those years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I retired from WHO about 8 years ago, 2012. And my primary motivation was to get back to academia, really to share all that I learned in the 13 years I was at WHO. And I was very fortunate to have been given the opportunity in Singapore not to join a school of medicine or a school of public health, but a school of public policy. And we are basically involved in running masters in public policy, graduate programs, masters of public administration, where most of our students are government scholars from the region, not just from Singapore, who have been sort of handpicked for future leadership positions. So the dean, Professor Kishore Mahbubani, who recruited me, basically said, look, you know, these are future leaders, not just in health, but across all the line ministries. And why don't you bring your experience on global health policy to this mix of, you know, students who come from economics, from foreign affairs, political science, environmental science, etc. So it's been a very rewarding experience these last 8 years to interact with these very bright students from the region to try and sort of share what my 13 years at WHO taught me about the importance of having health policies being driven by evidence, especially in developing countries when there are so many other competing priorities. So that's been sort of the move that straddled Geneva and Singapore.
Yeah, you know, I think we hadn't spoken for quite a few years, and I was really fascinated to see how you had moved into looking at some of the complexity of tobacco control and particularly harm reduction, and having deep insight into particularly Indonesia, not far from Singapore, where the smoking rate among men is about the highest in the world at 65%. I'd love to learn what actually attracted you to start looking at this field as a as an area of big neglect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, I would say, almost accidental entry into the tobacco harm reduction arena. It all started, I guess, way back when I was a student at university. You know, I don't mind sharing with you that I was actually almost a communist, sort of socialist, even leftist in my inclination. So always been very strong on the whole issue of equity. And I think you and I know that if you walk in the front building of WHO, it's very clearly stated that the mission of the organization is the highest attainable level of health for all people.
Yeah.
So it was, I think, about maybe two and a half years ago when one of my colleagues in the Lee Kuan Yew School, a chap called Donald Lau, who you might be familiar with, as well as another colleague, Jeremy Lim, actually during coffee, they were telling me, have you heard about this sort of ongoing debate that WHO is resisting evidence on the potential benefits of harm reduction strategies? I said, no, never heard of it. So at that point, they basically alerted me, I think, first of all, to the Public Health England report, the first report, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and then the National Academy of Medicine in the US, and all the literature around it. And it then basically brought me to my roots when I was working with Julio, evidence for policy. So it just immediately triggered in my mind, why is it that smokers who could really benefit from these evidence-based interventions are being denied access to their human right to have better health and to avoid premature death? So that was the trigger that sort of got me involved. And of course, I started looking more and more at the evidence, became more and more convinced. But of course, very soon ran into the brick wall. As you know, the Singapore government takes a pretty hardline stance on this. But it's been an interesting journey. And I think the nice thing is allowed me to reconnect with you after all those years.
Yeah, and it is fascinating that you and Ethan Nadelman both shared giving the Mike Russell Memorial Lecture, I'd done that a few years before on harm reduction and linking again back to the early evidence of Mike Russell all those years ago in England, showing that it wasn't nicotine that was killing and what it means going forward. But I just wonder for a country like Indonesia, where there's 65% smoking rate among men, what do you feel is actually something that could be done to start moving the agenda there, given that this takes a huge toll on people's lives?
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, I want to be more optimistic about my country, but, you know, the current situation makes it look like a pretty sort of uphill kind of battle because of sort of very entrenched positions of the tobacco control community. There is the National Commission for Tobacco Control, which has been over the last 20, 30 years, a very, very powerful voice, which absolutely refuses to sort of be even a little bit open about the growing evidence. Plus, of course, the strong sort of economic, political dimensions of tobacco industry in general. As you know, about maybe up even up to 20% of government income comes from tobacco excise tax. Yeah. And you always have the argument from the Ministry of Agriculture, for example, what are you going to do with the 2 million tobacco farmers? The Ministry of Industry will say, what are you going to do with the 300,000 people that work in tobacco manufacturing, etc., etc. So the Ministry of Health has always been quite committed to this, at least, unfortunately, not the current minister, but previous minister. You remember our colleague Nafsia Mboy. Nafsia yeah. was very strongly pushing for, you know, trying to increase tobacco prices, for example. But she's always in a fighting, in a sort of losing battle with the more powerful ministries such as finance and agriculture. Interestingly, the way one glimmer of hope that I've seen happen, perhaps in the last maybe 2 years or so, quite recent, was that you may recall that up to about a year and a half ago, the Ministry of Health were still actually pushing for banning e-cigarettes, for example. And then, interestingly, the Ministry of Finance started to get involved because they imposed a 57% tax on electronic cigarettes. So it then became like a bit of a change in the dynamics. The Ministry of Finance is saying, well, you know, this is a form of generating income. And the Ministry of Health then, in a way, sort of backtracked a little bit. So I think there's now maybe a bit of a glimmer of hope towards rather more regulation rather than outright bans. The big issue, of course, is the extent of the excise tax. And that's where the battle is on at the moment. Having said that, there are quite a few active groups, harm reduction groups, within the country. Quite a few NGOs. There are also a few academic institutions with some academics who are strong supporters, a few think tanks as well. But unfortunately, I think the mainstream academic institutions like the University of Indonesia, our oldest university, is still very much in the sort of anti-harm reduction mode. So I'm a little bit pessimistic, but you know, just in the past 2 or 3 years, I've just kept on trying to sort of continue advocating, giving seminars. In fact, we were supposed to do 2 seminars just in the last 2 or 3 months, but that's obviously had to be postponed. I've been commissioned by a health NGO to do a policy report on how to promote better harm reduction policies in Indonesia. So I'm doing that, and I'm also just writing a lot of op-eds for them. We interestingly have also run a little bit of media resistance about publishing things along the lines of harm reduction. Perhaps some of these media don't want to upset the government situation. So I've had to change tack a little bit. In fact, I'm writing an op-ed right now on COVID-19 and smoking. So I'm trying to sort of come at it from a slightly different angle.
Well, I'd love to. I mean, because in many ways that goes back to your roots. I mean, you've got the credibility right. of having worked as an immunologist and infectious disease right. person. Yeah. So if you can give us a clue, what's the sort of issues that you're going to raise, if you can?
Yeah, I'm basically going to tackle this ongoing controversy. You know, as you know, one group says smoking is protective. It prevents you from getting severe COVID. The other one says that it's actually the other way around. I mean, intuitively, it's hard to accept that smoking can actually protect you from a severe lung disease. So what I'm going to do is to basically just lay out the two sides of the argument to say that, you know, at this point in time, it's very difficult to determine because of the differences in the studies, the way the studies have been done, the way the patients have been selected, et cetera, that at the moment, it's hard to say whether it's protective or detrimental, but it doesn't get away from the fact that from a public health angle, smoking is bad for you. Because
yeah.
I don't think anybody will argue that smoking is a primary risk factor for heart disease and hypertension, which are the primary comorbidities for COVID-19 mortality in older people. You know, so that's going to be the basic argument that I'm going to try and push.
And I think you're on good grounds with both the NIH and the FDA saying that we need better clarity, and better clarity means decent science, and something we agree.
Yeah,
but as you said, you know, we went into COVID-19 with smoking being the biggest cause of preventable death in the world, and we're exiting with the same.
Right.
Just being in Singapore, I'd love just a few reflections on how you feel things are going in terms of the management of COVID-19, and particularly one thing which we saw very early across Korea, Singapore, China, was the use of masks and social distancing pretty quickly. And yet here in the US, we're still battling and we're still struggling to get acceptance of these fairly simple but very important social means to protect people.
Yeah, I mean, just in the last month, I've lost count of the number of interviews and webinars I participated in. But just very briefly, I think the Singapore success has been predicated on basically three legs of a tripod. The first leg is a robust healthcare system, the ability to test rapidly and extensively, the ability to isolate and restrict movement, the ability to do contact tracing, absolutely critical, and absolutely important also is risk communication to the public. And of course, you know, a very strong healthcare system that were able to take care of the severe cases and keep the fatalities down to only about 20. So that's the first leg of the tripod, the healthcare system. The second one is social capital. I think Singapore is a country where the population has a lot of trust in government generally. They're fairly compliant, they're fairly obedient in terms of just, you know, following instructions from the government. So I think social capital is very important. And the third dimension I think that's particularly important is governance. Very strong, unified, interagency task force, which had a unity in purpose, very well coordinated, and importantly, free from political interference and very much science and evidence driven. So those were the three things. But as you probably know, just in the last 3 weeks, we've had an explosion of cases. It's more than 23,000 at the moment, which actually makes it the highest in Southeast Asia. But don't be fooled by the numbers. This was, in a way, a little bit unanticipated. And 95% of these cases are in the dormitories of the foreign workers. Okay, but once again, they have been very rapidly quarantined, isolated. Importantly, they are very well taken care of. There have been no fatalities amongst them, only sort of mild disease. But I think it illustrates that even as we've seen in Korea in the last few days, that the capacity to fight fires when it happens is, I think, another important dimension. I think the Koreans are very worried about this last 24, 48 hours of cases, new clusters happening all the time. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is, of course, related to the presence of asymptomatic carriers that probably out there, you know, and if you have super spreaders amongst them, who knows, they could be out there still spreading the virus.
Yeah, I mean, just one last thought. I think those three characteristics are ones that we hope countries would emulate.
Right.
And certainly the first reminds me of the efforts almost 20 years ago by WHO to push essential public health functions, good surveillance, good data capabilities, good infrastructure for public health, which kind of went away over the last few decades we've moved on to other things. And yet it's that basic infrastructure that all the countries who seem to do relatively well have invested in for decades and decades.
I mean, the bottom line, Derek, is strengthening your health systems, you know, in a holistic manner. And I think in Singapore and in Indonesia, one bad side effect of this, almost completely focusing on COVID is some other diseases are being neglected. Singapore, just in the last 3 weeks, has seen a huge surge in dengue cases. Okay? So that's going to happen. In Indonesia, it's tuberculosis. That's, you know, in the long term, you need a robust, strong health system that's able to deal with, let's say, multiple threats.
Yeah. No, and we saw it across Africa when, in the early stages of the HIV/AIDS investments, that everything else, childhood vaccines, undernutrition, other things suffered. Well, I meant to thank you enormously for this, Tiki, and it's been wonderful to connect. I hope you and your family stay safe and keep doing the work you're doing. We need it. And I want people to also know that you can get hold of us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. Please be in touch and remember, stay safe. And the future will be better if we all stick to doing what we need to do. Thank you very much.